today, looking back at 2020, the most shocking year that many of us have ever experienced, with The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner. On the 1st of January 2020, the newspapers were full of stories about Australian bushfires.
But the most intense blazes here have turned the skies a bright amber.
Tensions between the US and Iran.
Tonight's missile attack by the Iranians against two military bases in Iraq that house American troops is the latest in a heightened crisis between the two countries.
And a businessman being smuggled out of Japan in a guitar case.
The rumour and suggestion I'm talking about involves a train trip to Osaka, a hotel, a box, and a flight in a two private jets via Turkey.
In Britain, the Conservatives were revelling in their 80-seat majority, boycotting parts of the BBC, and talking about getting Brexit done.
And with this mandate and this majority, we will at last be able to do what?
Get Brexit done!
We've been paying attention.
It was also the day that the World Health Organization woke to news of a novel coronavirus in Wuhan, China.
Chinese experts reportedly found a new coronavirus that traces back to the outbreak in Wuhan. And
a disease that was going to dramatically change the way we lived our lives as it swept like a tsunami through Asia and into Europe and beyond, killing almost 2 million people and bringing the world's economies to their knees. It was the scenes in Italy that made people in Britain sit up and take notice.
Within the past couple of hours, the Italian Prime Minister has announced restrictions on movement across the entire country.
Chaotic hospitals.
This is the front line in Italy's battle against the coronavirus. A battle, doctors say, they're losing.
Desperate patients struggling to breathe. Lines of coffins and empty streets. Scenes that will define a terrible year that has at least ended with a glimmer of hope.
In the last few minutes, the UK's mass vaccination programme against coronavirus has begun.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, looking back at 2020 with The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner. We'll talk about the policy response to COVID-19, but first let's talk about the human impact. There was that cliche at the start of this that the virus doesn't discriminate, but it very quickly did, didn't it?
You still hear people saying that today, and it's just absolutely not true. I mean, you're much more likely to get ill from COVID and to be in intensive care from COVID and die from COVID if you're from a deprived background or if you're from a Black, Asian, minority, ethnic background.
This is totally disproportionate, isn't it? Black and ethnic minority communities make up, about 15% of the general population, but 72% of the deaths of the NHS and care workers.
This is something that we pushed on very, very early on. We did lots of data-led reporting to show that this is the case. And I feel very strongly that the government still isn't taking this seriously enough. And it's also a really important sign of what needs to change in the country and how COVID has sort of exacerbated really serious problems that were here before.
What struck you out of those early stories and the early pictures that we saw?
I mean, what was overwhelming about early case studies we found is how many of them were doctors and how many of them were older Asian men.
These are the faces of dozens of health workers who've given their lives as they cared for others. We may not know exact numbers, but their pictures alone tell a story. It's startling to see just how many were from Black, Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds.
And when we dug into the stories, we found out that they had often felt that they'd been pushed forward to work on the front line, perhaps in a way that their colleagues weren't, and that they felt they didn't have enough PPE.
Hi there, Mr. Hancock. You might know my father, Dr. Chowdhury. When he was unwell, he wrote an open letter to the Prime Minister pleading for more PPE for NHS frontline workers. It was a request that was ignored. 2 weeks later, he passed away. And since then, over 100 NHS and social care workers have passed away from contracting the virus.
And also people working on the front line. And obviously there's a big overlap between those two groups. An interesting thing that we did some projects, there's a great project in the Guardian US called Lost on the Frontlines, where we profile the health workers who've been killed by COVID. We did a similar project in the UK. And when I approached the Australian team a few months ago, they said, oh, yes, we'll happily participate, but there haven't been any health workers killed in Australia. I mean, I think...
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a few months ago. But I think, again, this disease doesn't affect every country the same. What this disease does, it shows up what kind of country you are.
What do you mean by that?
Well, China were able to get the disease under control, and they did that through drastic authoritarianism.
Half of the country's 1.4 billion population now under some form of lockdowns or travel restrictions. That is just a staggering number.
I think lots of Asian countries took this coronavirus seriously because they knew what had happened in the past.
The fight against COVID-19, East Asia is ahead of the curve.
And, you know, South Korea has epidemiologists high up in government. In Britain, I think it shows up what an unequal country we are. I think in England, the focus has been on Britain first, England first, we're the best at everything.
At no stage has our NHS been overwhelmed.
Contrasting this with the Scottish government's approach, which was much more humble and cautious and serious.
There are early optimistic signs that the steps we are taking are working, but until we know more, until we have solid evidence, we must stick with it.
And then you look at the rest of Europe, lots of great healthcare systems, and yet politically, nobody's been able to get a hold of it.
Just thinking about the UK for the moment, it clearly was a game changer for the government. As you say, they had just come out of a massive election victory at the beginning of the year. They were tub-thumping about Brexit. They were boycotting the Today programme. They had a levelling up agenda that they were going to talk about. In March, actually, when we went into lockdown, their approval ratings were through the roof. Now, that has changed. But at the time, it was almost seen as unseemly to criticise, either for the opposition or for journalists. How did you handle that to make sure that you held the government to account?
It's really interesting you say that, Anushka, because I really noticed that as well. And I think a lot of the other newspapers really held back in those first few months. And I really felt like that we shouldn't. We should be holding them to account. This matters. And so we pushed very hard on investigations into PPE.
He had set up and incorporated a company. This was a business that was looking to act as an agent in the PPE market.
Into care homes.
I think it was suddenly reality. God, you know, we've got it in this home. We now have to really get into sort of action and isolated all of our residents in their bedrooms.
Mass gatherings.
The policy was that the virus was being allowed to spread at that point.
Because it sort of sounds logical that stopping a mass event is going to be a big way to stop this. In fact, it's a small way to stop it.
We wanted to find out who was attending SAGE meetings. If you remember, the membership of those was kept secret until we busted open.
The lack of transparency about what the government calls the science means that it's hard to know how much of this comes from SAGE and how much of it is political interpretation.
You know, VIP contracts for friends of people in government and so on.
And it turned out that HINPACK had won around £30 million worth of work making test tubes for these government COVID test kits. It had no previous experience in making medical products, which seemed odd.
It was really, really important that we pushed on every front because governments have to be accountable in crises.
Breaking news coming into us within the past few seconds. The Prime Minister has been under the care of doctors in a hospital in London, and he is being now admitted into intensive care with those persistent symptoms of coronavirus.
Do you remember how you felt when you first heard Boris Johnson was going into hospital and then ICU? What were you thinking in terms of covering it?
We had good sources on this story and we knew exactly what was going on with the Prime Minister's health. And it was obviously very alarming. I mean, lots of people in Number 10 had already got ill, but he was very ill indeed. And I think there were about 48 hours when it looked like his life was in danger. Whether you support the Prime Minister or not, there's something very disturbing about the Prime Minister's life being at risk. And I think people took the crisis very, very seriously after that.
And of course, he did recover. And in the aftermath, there was a lot of controversy for the government, not only around a slow response to the crisis and questions around the spiralling death rate.
But now it's official. England has the highest level of excess mortality in Europe.
And policy U-turns.
Labour trying to turn the focus on to what it sees as the government's U-turns.
But also, how many senior figures in government fell ill? Not just the Prime Minister and Health Secretary.
The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, seen here just 2 days ago at Prime Minister's Questions, has also tested positive.
But the Chief Medical Officer and Chief Strategist, Dominic Cummings. And it was, of course, his behaviour at that time that led to the news scoop of the year.
The Guardian is also reporting that a witness saw Mr Cummings at the grounds of his parents' home near Durham with a young child on April the 5th. Less than 7 days after displaying symptoms. He was photographed in Downing Street just over a week later.
When did our reporter, Matt Weaver, first tell you that he had sightings of Dominic Cummings in Durham? And did you realise how big that story was going to be?
We heard several weeks before we went with the story. We didn't have the full story, but we had some elements of it and we'd put it to number 10. And they did what Dominic Cummings at number 10 did with Guardian stories, which is completely blank us. They didn't respond. And so we were trying to work out what you can do. And it was, in fact, once we heard about the Mirror, it gave us the other half of the story, which meant that we were able to go with it even without a response from number 10. I didn't think it would be as big as it was, I have to be honest with you. I remember being worried at the time, this is unbelievable, but I was worried at the time that people still care so much about breaking lockdown. I remember thinking that. I remember going home that Friday night. I went home that Friday night and saying, I wonder how big this is going to be. And it was pretty big on the Friday night. But you know, what made it really big was on Saturday when all those cabinet ministers came out to defend him.
The guidance says, if you're living with children, keep following this advice to the best of your ability. However, we are aware that not all these measures will be possible, depending, therefore, on circumstances. I'm adding those last few words. In other words, if you are in a position where you've got a young child, in this case 4 years old, and you are worried about the welfare of that child and your ability to throw around them the wider network of support, then you're clearly being somewhere where other members of the family can assist, by which I mean in this case.
And when it became obvious that the Prime Minister was not going to sack him, I think if the Prime Minister had sacked him that morning, I don't think it would have been such a huge story. But as it was, it just said, we are different from the rest of you. You know, and I have to say, the story made me angry on Friday. But what really made me angry was on the Saturday when all those cabinet ministers were defending it, saying, you know, is it a crime to look after your wife and child?
Would you go on a 60-mile round trip to test your eyesight?
I have, on occasions in the past, driven with my wife in order to make sure that... what's the right way of putting it?
I'm staggered. I don't know how you're going to get out of this one, but it's going to be fun.
No.
You know, we're talking about several months when people had not been able to hold the hands of their dying mothers. They hadn't been able to see the people they loved. They had made massive compromises. And the reason that they had managed to do that was because they thought, we're all in this together. We're going to work together not to overwhelm the NHS. And this matters. Whoever you are, we're all in it together. And, you know, those people, they're not going to be able to go to the funeral that happened 3 weeks ago. They're not going to be able to hold the hand of the parent who died. It's gone. They're gone. And I felt so angry that Dominic Cummings had made a mockery of that, made a mockery of those sacrifices and those compromises. And Boris Johnson did too by not sacking him. And then when he sacked him at the end of the year over a kind of, you know, office politics, you did rather think, well, you could have sacked him, you know, to send a message to the country. And as a way of sort of saying to all those people who made all those sacrifices that those sacrifices weren't in vain. But I really, really fear for what all of that has done to trust in politicians. You know, the public trusted politicians to behave well and they didn't.
Why do you think Boris Johnson wanted to keep him so badly? And why do you think they held that press conference in the Rose Garden?
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. Yesterday, I gave a full account to the Prime Minister of my actions.
I mean, at the time, what was believed was that there was no Boris Johnson without Dominic Cummings, that he was so reliant on him, quite fearful of him, we were told, that he simply couldn't or wouldn't. But it looks so astonishing at the end of the year now, doesn't it? You know, like you said, Tory MPs in safe seats had their email inboxes full of loyal Tory voters who were furious because this affected all of us. All of us made compromises in that period. And Dominic Cummings's excuses, which, you know, played us for fools. No one was going to believe that you'd take a day trip to Barnard Castle to test your eyesight. It's preposterous. It's ridiculous. And it makes us feel ridiculous to hear it. So I think it was just one big way of saying that you don't matter. I don't know why he didn't sack him, but I do know that it had a really big impact on public trust. I think no one quite knew how seriously to take the rules from then on.
So that was the 22nd of May, and it is hard to believe that just 3 days later, the world was going to change in another way.
The protests began here after this video went viral. The police officer pressed his knee into the neck of George Floyd and kept it there for more than 8 minutes. He's been charged with third-degree murder.
Did you watch the video of George Floyd dying?
I have watched it. I have to say, I slightly wish I hadn't. I think it is one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen. I mean, it shouts for his mum. And you just don't know how you can see what's happening. But the police officer kneeling on his neck doesn't seem to care. It's a very, very disturbing image, I think.
What did you make of the reaction?
Well, it made a lot of sense. I mean, I think Black Americans have been protesting against their treatment by the police for a long time.
Our lives matter. Black lives matter.
And Black Lives Matter as an idea, sort of as a concept, dates back to Trayvon Martin's murder by a vigilante in 2012. But there was something about the George Floyd murder, and I think the police officer's disdain and the way he cried for his mother moved it onto another level.
And what he said, "I can't breathe."
Yeah, I mean, that is a line for the ages, isn't it?
One of the things that was just repeated time and again in the reaction as you watched it was this sense of people saying they're tired.
We're tired, we're exhausted, we're tired of trying to reason with a country that was not built for Black and brown lives.
What do you think they meant by that?
Yeah, they were saying that they were sort of exhausted of having to fight against this sort of thing. How could this still be something that needed fighting for? How could this not be obvious that this shouldn't exist in our society? I think also, I mean, I don't think personally it's a coincidence that the biggest race protest in decades came about in the middle of the COVID crisis.
I can't breathe.
Because I think, first of all, what we talked about earlier, that the COVID crisis, like all crises, affect Black members of society disproportionately. But also I think, you know, there was something about the COVID crisis that makes you think, you know, enough is enough on everything.
And that link was most stark, perhaps, in the way that the protests spread to the UK. And as well as hearing George Floyd's name, you were hearing Belly Majinga's name. And there are questions about what actually happened and whether there was ever a spit and whether that was why she died. But just the very fact of this transport worker who had appeared to have been assaulted in Victoria Station and who went on to die from COVID seemed to represent so much about what was wrong, not just with America, but with Britain as well.
Yes, and Belly's story brought together both sort of crises, didn't it? I think, you know, the fact that she was on the front line, like a lot of Black workers are.
Follow the procedure, wash your hands, avoid contact with people, try to be safe yourself.
The idea that this passenger spat on her, which it's such an aggression. And then the fact that she died so quickly and left behind her little girl, you know, it did seem to bring together the COVID crisis and racism.
And one of the projects that arose out of all of this, and in particular out of the protests that were erupting here in the UK, was Amna Modin and Lucy Campbell's Young British and Black series at the end of July. What was the goal of that project?
We wanted to hear from protesters about why they were protesting. But I think we very specifically as well wanted to understand the Black British identity. I think something that's really emerged very strongly this year is Black Britons saying, you know, we don't always want to be the American story. We have a story of our own.
We asked everyone, what does it mean to be black in the UK today? And I was taken back by how many of the participants' response were just positive. They talked about Jay Huss. They talked about this new kind of collaboration that we see with grime and Afrobeats. They talked about brilliant books such as Reni Eddo-Lodge's Why I'm Not Talking to White People About Race.
And I think there's been lots of interesting things that have come out. I think Steve McQueen's fantastic series Small Axe is very much about sort of telling the Black British story. We've tried to do it with our Black Lives series to throw light on sort of Black British heroes and heroines who you may not have heard of.
What did you make within all of that of statues being torn down?
I think it's an incredibly interesting thing. That moment when the Edward Colston statue was toppled in Bristol.
Hey, someone say something!
You know, he was a slave trader. And you ask, well, why have we got monuments to slave traders in our cities? And who should we have monuments to? And I think to reappraise that and to sort of say, well, we think about things differently now than we thought about them then, I think is actually really exciting.
The past few years have been really difficult for many people on the left or people who might describe themselves as liberals, particularly in the US and UK. Many have turned to a news organisation like The Guardian during that time, during Brexit and then during a Trump presidency. As we approached November 2020, how nervous do you think people like that were about the idea of the president being re-elected?
I think they were completely and utterly terrified. I think Americans were in fear for their lives. And I think people all around the world were worried about what it might mean for them and what it might mean for culture and, of course, most particularly for the environment.
How were you feeling about it?
Similarly.
Did you think he was going to win?
I did think he would lose, but I really cautioned myself not to assume that that was the case.
One of the reporters we spoke to a few times was the US Southern Bureau chief, Oliver Lachland, who did travel across America, talking to as many voters as he could for the Guardian's Anywhere But Washington video series.
You think Trump's going to win here?
Is that a serious question?
Joe Biden will drive this country into the ground.
4 years!
Do you think Joe Biden speaks to younger people of colour in this country?
No. I mean,
that's very honest.
Yeah, I have to be really clear with that one. However, I think that Joe Biden is overwhelmingly the best choice for the job.
What did you guys make of the reports about Trump's taxes?
It's not your business, it's not their business. Whatever he paid, so what?
What struck you about his reporting and what he found?
I mean, it was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? What struck me most, though, was just how divided the country was. We know it's become polarised, but it just seemed to be entirely separate, two entirely different nations with different sources of news, different set of facts, different belief systems. And that's a really, really hard situation for a new president to deal with.
It's election night in America and a nation in crisis is at a crossroads.
And then came election night, which was somehow incredibly shocking, even though what happened had been widely predicted. This idea that there would be a surge for Donald Trump on the night and then a slower shift towards Joe Biden in the days afterwards as the postal votes piled up and Trump refusing to concede. I mean, tell me about that night. How shocking was it for you?
I think that's a really good point because I think Trump managed to shock us all the way along for the 4 years. We never really got to not be shocked. You know, he kept doing shocking things the whole time. You know, I'm sure he still will. He is a very disruptive person. So on the night, like everyone else, I was anxious because although this is exactly what we expected, as you say, and we knew that the postal votes were going to fall much more to Biden, once Trump won Florida, you started to think, gosh, is it really possible that it could happen again?
Coming up, 2020 takes a positive turn. Catherine, this has been quite a year. We've lost so many people to the virus. Lockdown has shattered the way we live our lives. It's been extremely stressful. People have lost jobs. Their businesses are struggling. We're in a recession. Hunger and homelessness are rising. In many ways, 2020 has become symbolic of everything that can go wrong. But things have also shifted. For many Americans in particular, but others around the world, Donald Trump being voted out of the White House was great news. And then suddenly we had a vaccine.
Pfizer executives are calling it one of the biggest medical breakthroughs in the past 100 years. A COVID vaccine developed in just 6 months.
With an efficacy rate of 90% plus. That was a huge week, wasn't it?
Yes, and it was almost like we couldn't believe that that week had happened, couldn't we? Because we'd waited so long for anything positive. There's no doubt that the end of Trump is a very, very significant thing for the world. It's significant for the climate. It's significant for lying in public life, for respect in public life, for how you talk to people, how you treat people. I think of the Van Jones tearful comment on TV.
Van, what are your thoughts? Well, it's easier to be a parent this morning. It's easier to be a dad. It's easier to tell your kids character matters. It matters. Tell them the truth matters.
He sort of said, you know, I can tell my son that this is a good man, Joe Biden. This is who you want to be, rather than having Trump at the top of everything. So it was an inspiring moment in all sorts of ways. The vaccine is just quite astonishing. And I think the fact that the two came quite quickly on the back of each other, the fact that it's this new kind of technology, which people have been excited about for a few years, but this is the real deal now, that it's this kind of simple and quite beautiful technology, so scientists say, the fact that it has such a huge success rate. If you remember that people were saying 50, 60% success rate,
not from one, but from potentially three.
Yeah, and there's more coming too, using different types of technology. I think it shows the power of science when everyone is aimed at the same thing. We had a great article this week that said, don't be alarmed that the approval process for the COVID vaccine has been so fast. Just be annoyed that the approval process for most drugs is so slow. So yeah, it's a very exciting moment. And you do just start to think, we really could turn the corner next year. We could be back together. We could be maybe out in a bar, Anoushka.
Having a drink.
Talking to strangers. And maybe all of those vulnerable people can relax and into their futures.
I mean, it is amazing, isn't it, that if you set the kind of scientific world an unbelievable challenge like COVID, then my goodness, didn't they rise to the challenge? But as you say, this could be game-changing for other things. Say a similar challenge was set for the world, for the planet, for the environment. I mean, do you think that in this year that we are now going to get COP26, you could then start getting this sort of response?
That's what you would hope, but we need the political will behind it. And I think people making the link between the climate crisis and the COVID crisis would be a real help with that. And that's something we're trying to do. The pandemic is a result of our annihilation of nature year after year, which has brought novel microbes into contact with people. And I think the sooner politicians accept that and wake up to that and start tackling that, the better. All of this is linked to the climate crisis. You know, I've always said it's the biggest story of our lifetimes, and it still is.
And of course, as we speak, Brexit looks like it's about to happen in one way or another.
Post-Brexit trade talks resume today, but are said to be on a knife edge.
Yes, good morning. Still no agreement on...
How are you feeling about that?
Anxious. Anxious, because obviously no deal is a complete catastrophe, but even the deal that we could get is still a pretty hard Brexit, so it's pretty bad.
And so as we come out of 2020, it has been a very, very dark year. It has ended with a bit of light and hope, but we're still sitting in the Guardian headquarters that are pretty much empty, and we're still looking at some time probably before we come out of this. But how hopeful are you for 2021, and what do you take away from the year that we've just had personally and for this organisation?
I've been coming in almost every day since the start of the pandemic, and it's just completely empty, mostly dark, silent. And obviously I've got used to it, but just a couple of weeks ago, I suddenly looked round and thought, there's no one here. And it was like I'd suddenly sort of admitted what had actually happened, you know, because I think we've all been carrying on in a state of suspended animation, haven't we? You know, we've just got to try and get through this. And then perhaps with the news of the vaccines, you start to get the feel the end was in sight, and you suddenly were able to sort of admit just how strange and unsettling and disorientating this year has been in every way. I mean, you've got to have hope for next year. There's no longer Donald Trump in the White House. There are vaccines. And I hope that really serious issues such as the environment, poverty and inequality will be seriously tackled. I hope people will realise that this means that terrible things can happen and we need to stop them happening again. So absolutely, you have to have hope.
And of course we want to be hopeful, but it has been a weird year in terms of not seeing loved ones. You know, I've now decided not to see my parents over Christmas. I'm feeling really depressed about that. We've had months and months away from people. We've not been able to get together and have a night out. What have you missed? And what are you going to do the moment that we are all vaccinated?
It's true, isn't it? I mean, it's the year that you've missed everyone. You've missed the people you love. You've missed the people you see every day. You miss everyone in between. You just miss everyone. And it's reminded us, I think, that life is all about human connection. It's the main thing we've got. It's the main thing that brings us together and makes us human. And so the minute I can, Anoushka, I will be taking full advantage of that and being in the closest possible contact with as many possible people as I can.
Here's to 2021. Catherine Viner, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anoushka.
That was The Guardian's editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, looking back on quite a year. In Saturday's print edition of The Guardian, there is a special 24-page supplement telling the story of 2020, the year we lost to coronavirus. And there are going to be some brilliant pieces, including from Today in Focus regulars. Jonathan Friedland has written about how the pandemic has acted like a magnifying glass on society, exposing all that is good and bad. Our health editor, Sarah Bosley, has written about what we know now about how it began. And science editor, Ian Sample, on the greatest scientific collaboration in history. Do buy it and enjoy. The pieces will go up online over the next week at theguardian.com. Now, before we go, I have some really sad news to share. This summer, I spoke to a 28-year-old man called Sherwin Hall, who was in pain for many months but struggled to get a scan because of the way that COVID-19 had disrupted cancer care in the NHS. When he was seen, unfortunately, he had a very aggressive and untreatable tumour and sadly has now passed away. I wanted to send all of our love to his family at this terrible time. Sherwin was incredibly brave to speak out when he did, and we really appreciate it. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Nicholas Alexander. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Hope you have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.